This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Across Australia, on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community radio stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9.
Hello and welcome to Word for Word. Dean Beck with you today. Now, my guest today was born in Hobart, but has managed to turn a life of creativity into one that has taken him into fashion and then costume, more recently, for the Australian Ballet. It's my great pleasure to welcome to Word for Word, Alexi Freeman. Welcome.
Hi, Dean. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. How does a young man from Hobart, born on Christmas Eve, turn a career of artistic creation into one that's self-sustainable in fashion and now costume? What's that story about? What were you like as a kid in Hobart?
I think growing up in Hobart, you know, it's quite a unique place to grow up in terms of, you know, it does in some ways have the sort of beauty of, you know, of being a really picturesque, you know, city at the end of the world, and it is a capital city of Australia, but at the same time it's also a small town. It is sort of like growing up in, you know, perhaps somewhere, you know, virtually regional Victoria, or, you know, like
Bendigo perhaps.
Yeah, I think it does have that sort of, you know, everyone, and you walk down the street and and everyone knows like each other's news, and, you know, it is a sort of challenging place to grow up, but I think it's kind of that thing of the innovation of necessity, or I don't know, it's like there's nothing to do, so either you turn to creativity or you turn to drugs or you turn to, you know, to God or to something. and in my case, it was creativity. So
it's become more recently a bit of a modern art hub, but in 1978, I wouldn't have presumed there were that many culturally artistic influences.
I'm not too clear what was going on in 78, to be honest. I think it was a Hawthorne Premiership year. But, I think there's always been a lot of artisans and craftspeople, and, you know, there's always been lots of, say, like, beautiful watercolour drawings of the harbour, and, you know, there's always been lots of creativity there in terms of sculpture and painting and drawing and that type of thing. But, yeah, I don't, and I think to this day, there isn't really much of a fashion industry. There just isn't sort of the population to sort of support that.
What was high school like for you?
I went to a private boys' school, and they had their sesquicentenary in, I think I would have been in grade 12 had I stayed there. And without mentioning them by name, they, you know, it was pretty much a fascist dictatorship. Like, if my fringe got, you know, within like 1 inch of my eyebrows, you know, you could pretty much be suspended. Like, if you didn't walk home with, you know, your blazer combination of shirt, like socks pulled up and tie done, you know, it was very fascist.
And they were out policing that.
They were, yeah, and, you know, the prefects could come and give you detention, and, you know, I mean, once I gave myself an undercut, you know, back in the late 80s, I guess it was, or something, and I actually got suspended indefinitely. It was like, until your hair grows back to a suitable level.
4 weeks or something.
That you're allowed to study. So it was pretty, but after that, I went to Hobart College, and that was cruisy and had a great time.
Were you picked on?
I think the fact that Alexi, you know, it's still probably by many people is considered to be, I mean, it's a Russian name. It's very, you know, it's like being called John in Russia, you know, and in Greece, but in my case, Russia. Like, it you know, it was definitely considered to be a girl's name. And the fact that I was in a choir and I played piano and, you know, I kind of wanted to fight with my mind, not with my fists, you know, didn't really serve me well through high school. So I think I was sort of the challenge for a lot of macho kind of, you know, young men who wanted to assert themselves. But that said, you know, I never actually got hurt. Mm. I just, you know, they just like to chase me around a bit, which is fine.
You learned to run fast.
Yeah, good runner.
So how did they, how did that creative bud start to bloom? How did it evolve for you?
I think as a sort of turning point, perhaps, in terms of being in this quite oppressive kind of high school environment and, you know, and Hobart being not exactly the cultural capital of the universe. On my 15th birthday, I went to a gig by a band called Mouth, and it was their last gig, and they were kind of pretty influenced by Joy Division and possibly like Bauhaus and sort of maybe like the Stooges and Big Black and sort of all that kind of genesis of alternative rock and roll in the UK and in America. And that was really like I was introduced to, you know, a whole community of people that were into this music, and it was just, you know, worlds apart from anything that I'd experienced before. And I think that night I sort of went, wow, like the world's actually quite an interesting place and anything goes.
Where did the fashion sort of spark start to burn? You know, where did that come from?
Well, back then, now I think, you know, grade 7 students can do a fashion elective in, you know, in Frankston, but in Hobart in the, you know, in the 80s,
in the private boys' school,
there was certainly no fashion subject, but there was an art subject, and my, you know, and my art teacher was quite encouraging, and, you know, it was probably the thing, like, I was sort of, you know, I was a good student in terms of in everything, in maths and stuff, but, like, as in, you know, not only creative subjects, but he was quite encouraging, and I think, you know, I went to art school straight out of grade 11, and I, you know, I started doing sculpture and printmaking and drawing and painting and everything. You know, you have to do a bit of everything to start. And I just, for whatever reason, I started making these kind of wearable sculptures. And I started, like, going to junkyards and getting wire out of old TVs and crocheting them into, like, outfits for myself. And, you know, which in a small town like that, it did sort of raise a few
eyebrows.
Stand
out a little, yeah.
But to me, I don't know, like it just seemed like the natural thing to do at the time.
So your evolution artistically was, did it come from the drawing side of things, or was it the sculptural, if you like, craft, hands-on side of things?
Both. Yeah, okay. I mean, I've always been into drawing, and yeah, certainly at school from an early age, you know, they did sort of nurture that in me, like it was something that, you know, I sort of did, and someone, a teacher or other students, were sort of like, oh, you know, you're good at drawing, and you sort of go, oh, like, and you keep, you know, you sort of do, you know, you keep going with those things. But it wasn't until art school that actually there really was an opportunity for me to sort of get into really working with my hands and sort of, you know, the more artisanal side of things. And I think it's that that really led into first, yeah, wearing things myself and then getting commissions from people to make things for them and then costume and then eventually fashion.
Fashion is a lot more than a good illustration, though. I mean, the likes of pattern making is an art in itself. The textile design combinations and construction is, in again, a different art again. So how was it that you managed to sort of mould into working in the arena? Because you sort of got to know a little bit of everything then.
You do. I mean, I've always been a believer that creativity, you know, it kind of flows through you. So whether you decide to be, you know, I mean, you know, engineers have to think really creatively, or, you know, whether it's something more stereotypically creative.
Some accountants can think very creatively.
Exactly. You know, so whether you choose to be a writer or a painter or an accountant or, you know, underwater ceramic technician, I don't know, there's always ways to think through whatever it is that your problem. So, like, it's problem solving in a way. So for me now, it's sort of, you know, it's women's clothing, and it's how do I shape a woman, you know, how do I clothe a woman's body in material that is, you know, A, relevant, B, you know, affordable for me to produce, C, you know, actually I have the technical requirements to do it. Like, there are all these kind of things. So it is, you know, it is engineering in that sense, but I think it's just, it's really problem solving, like, I think is ultimately what it is. Like, you have an idea, you have millions of ideas, but ultimately it's taking one idea and distilling that, you know, into a collection that's actually, you know, ticks all those boxes. It can be worn, it can be washed, you can wear it to work or the supermarket or a party or whatever you're into.
And at the end of the day, it's got to make some money, because
it does.
You can be terribly creative, but if it costs you that much to produce it and you can't get the markup to be sustainable or it takes so long, because plenty of creative people don't factor in their time.
Yeah.
And have come undone.
Yeah.
How do you get your head around that business side of things as a fashion designer?
Practice, I'd say. It's probably, I'm sure in late last century when I was doing costume and, you know, I was probably in my late teens and people were coming to me wanting things, you know, I probably was more can-do. Like, I'm still pretty can-do, I think. But, you know, it was kind of like, yeah, sure, you just whatever, you know, kind of just let's make it happen. Yeah, and I'd do all-nighters and, you know, I probably was a my friends still think I'm a workaholic. But I think now I actually have a bit of a life balance, kind of work balance. But, yeah, back then it was just kind of like, yeah, let's just do this. And it was all about, you know, the labour of the love. Whereas now it is kind of like, you know, I can't work 7 days a week, 365 days a year for 10 years. I will get sick and die. Mm. So let's kind of work in a bit more sustainable way. But that said, I still probably do a few extra hours here and there, especially when, you know, the ballet comes along and says, oh, you know, do you want to... And it's like, well, I'm not going to stop doing two collections a year, so I'll just have to fit you in.
So let's talk about the Australian Ballet production that recently premiered. It's the Australian Ballet's 50th anniversary this year. And you did the costumes for Gideon Obazanik's There's Definitely a Prince Involved as part of a triple bill called Infinity. Gideon Obazanik, an amazing choreographer. What was it like working with him and the Australian Ballet Company? Did he come to you or did David come to you?
Well, when I was doing that labour of love in the 90s, I worked with a number of, you know, dancers and actors and singers and performers who, you know, are now further along in their career. And, you know, some of whom I've stayed in touch with. And, you know, I guess back at the time they were sort of like, you know, you do this for us and one day we'll kind of... And I think it kind of, in a way, it was one of those connections. Someone that I did some work for back then, she's now a lot further along in her career and we've kind of stayed in touch and I kind of said, hey, like, if you ever need someone, and she's been assisting Gideon. So I think she just, you know, all she did, I believe, is just put it under his nose and then the rest, as they say, is history.
But did you have to do some preliminary sketches or...?
In this case, the way that it happened was he saw some work online and then he called me, he said, can we meet? He came to my studio. We had a chat about life, you know, and lots of things not particularly related to the ballet. And then he just kind of said, so I've got this project coming up. It's for the ballet. Do you want to do it? And I just said yes. And that was that.
Alexi Freeman is our guest on Word for Word. We'll come back and explore a little bit more about his work with the Australian Ballet Company and some interesting exhibition that he has coming up too. All that and more on Word for Word today across Australia on the Community Radio Network.
On the Community Radio Network from Melbourne's Joy 94.9, this is Word for Word.
Dean Beck with you across Australia on the Community Radio Network. My guest, Alexi Freeman, is a fashion designer who has been working with the Australian Ballet on Gideon Obazanik's production There's Definitely a Prince Involved. Now, we spoke about your commission in getting this particular job. What challenges did designing these sorts of costumes for ballet dancers present? Because proportion is so important for dancers.
Proportion is important, as are a plethora of things,
including movements.
Yes, you know, the fact that you're viewing them from probably at least 10, perhaps up to 20, 25 metres away, depending on the theatre. You know, they're frottaging and grinding and writhing around on the floor, and you know, they're like, they really give each other a workout, and in that sense the costumes are very physical. As opposed to fashion, where, you know, some of those things may occur, but you know, generally clothes are more sort of for going places in public, and you know, maybe like dancing or like hugging, or you know, it's not so much this like really intense, like it's sort of a fraction too much friction, you might say.
And they sweat.
And they sweat and they tear holes in them, and they, you know, and that's what they're there for. What they're supposed to do. But yeah, I mean, look, I am used to, you know, making garments, you know, as part of my collection that people certainly could, you know, dance or do, you know, exercise in and such. But yeah, working with dancers, they really know how to kind of destroy things, like, you know, as quickly as possible. So yes, it was challenging, but a good challenge, and a nice break from, you know, the kind of rigmarole, I guess, of just doing regular fashion collections.
You say rigmarole, but what do you mean by that? Is it more tedious?
You know,
doing...
Look, I mean...
Or is it more creative doing the costume?
I think... Look, I love doing fashion, or else I wouldn't be doing it. That said, you know, whether you feel like it or not, there's four seasons a year and you have to design for those. I guess coming, you know, having worked as an artist before, sort of like you develop a concept, you work through it until it's finished, you present it when it's ready, you know, ideally. But, you know, it is sort of... You are kind of more working at your own pace... Whereas fashion, it's like whether you have an idea that you want to present or not, it's like bang, it's March, you have to put your winter out, you know, or bang, it's September, summer has to, you know, and of course it's really 6 months before that it needs to be ready. So, you know, I guess costume, I could have a bit more fun with it. It was something sort of outside of this. I did have someone to bounce off, being, you know, Gideon in particular, but also... You know, just the dancers contributed a lot to the work, and you know, it was just like a fun thing to do, probably.
And this particular story, it was a twist on the Swan Lake story.
It was, yeah. I think in very kind of signature Barzanek style, you know, he really invested his own sort of twist and personality, and his curiosity, you know, for the world, and in this case, you know, the world in general, but in this case, ballet and Swan Lake in particular. I think he was really, in a really relevant contemporary way, he was really exploring sort of, you know, why that work is so, you know, so
iconic,
loved,
yeah.
And yeah, seminal in the history of ballet. And, you know, he interviewed people, and
It presents its own challenges when you take on such something that's so well known.
It does. Yeah. And I really think, you know, hats off to him in terms of, you know, it's the Australian Ballet, it's their 50th year, you know, they're so heavily, you know, invested in by, you know, philanthropists and, you know, and the government. And, you know, it's, let's face it, it's classical ballet. And it's a company... wanting to move into the future, wanting to be contemporary. You know, David McAllister's definitely, by choosing these three works, you know, and I think this one in particular, he's definitely saying, let's move classical ballet forward. Let's not, you know, stick to our laurels and keep producing, you know, or remaking these works that we've done for sort of time immemorial or something. So, yeah, I think it was quite a challenging work for them to commission, and certainly for him to make as well.
And in saying all of that, they are this year doing a production of Swan Lake that is traditional to the extreme.
Well,
they're going
back to that. And that will probably, you know, keep a few people happy. And look, let's face it,
you've got to keep the patrons happy.
But it's an extraordinary work, and it deserves to be remade. But at the same time, it's 2012, you know, like... I think there does need to be works like this that ask questions about it, and it's not just, hey, it's a great work, let's do it forever, like Cats or something.
Bums on seats, though.
Yeah, it's actually, let's have a conversation, let's talk about it, let's see what this work, you know, why is the swan falling in love with the prince, and why is he, like, why does he want to kill her, and, you know, and these issues of, like, duality and, you know, virginity and lasciviousness and love and hate and death, and, you know, they're really relevant issues today as they have been for, you know, forever.
So how does that express itself in design?
Well, I mean, the challenge, I guess, with working with someone so creative and intuitive as Gideon is that, you know, as a costume designer, you can't make the costumes, you know, the day before or the week before or even the month before. You know, it all had to be kind of stitched up in a lot of ways 6 months in advance in terms of delivering the concept to the Australian Ballet and having that all approved and signed off on. So it was sort of having conversation, and in addition to that, he's sort of the busiest person on the planet. So it was literally having conversations, squeezing conversations in car parks in Richmond, you know, on a Saturday night or wherever I could meet him to sort of try and pick his brain for, you know, it's like, Gideon, what do you, you know, where are you going with this
work? What do you really want?
What do you want? So yeah, it was just kind of, you know, me trying to intuit where he wanted to go with it, because he doesn't, you know, he had his concept, but he doesn't know what the piece, or he didn't know what the piece would be until he got into the studio with the dancers and actually they thrashed it out.
And you know? So from that creative perspective, he comes out with a bit of a sketch, if you like, but what evolves is what we then later see.
That's right. Right. Yes.
Whew. That's a challenge for you, because where do you fit into that?
I mean, I guess, you know, you can't, you know, or in my case, I didn't want to put the kitchen sink in that. You know, it's not about...
You didn't get to see anything.
It's not about sitting on the fence and going, oh, well, you know, like, that's what he said. You know, I guess he's chosen me because he wants me to invest part of myself into it. So I did my best to interpret what he'd said. And, you know, and it is very much to do with kind of light and dark and good and evil and lasciviousness versus virginity and those types of things. So we did end up with this sort of monochromatic black and white kind of piece that, you know, also in terms of the duality that he wanted to explore, that all the have you seen the work? Like all the fringing, when they dance together, it all does sort of tangle and mesh together. And, you know, I think it does, you know, in terms of visually help to express that metaphor or that concept of duality and the black swan, white swan sort of grey area.
Now, Infinity, which is, as we said, part of the 50th anniversary program for Australian Ballet, has been performed here in Melbourne, but it opens in Sydney on the 5th of April. Will you be going up there to the opening? Or?
Look, hopefully. I mean, Gideon's so busy, he's going to be touring another work in America at that time, I believe, so he's not going to be back. I think the set designer will have to go up just for sort of technical reasons. My work's done. So if I go up, I'm just sort of going up for a holiday.
And the ballet would, I imagine, have their own core of costume people. So did you work closely with them as well?
I did. They have an incredible department. It's in-house down at their head office.
It's an amazing centre.
Yeah, it is. And they have, an incredible team of, artisan, craft people, fashion people, whatever you want to call them, pattern makers, machinists, milliners, dyers, you know, they do it all in-house. So was
your process amazing. Mainly the illustration, or did you have to work on construction as well? Or how did that evolve?
I definitely did a bit of both. Like, you know, I mean, to begin with, yes, it was developing the concept and then going in there and sort of working with them and figuring out sort of, you know, what's possible within the budget and the time frame and the skills that they have, and which, you know, which are extensive. But then, you know, I did end up sort of going in there, you know, not nearly every day for like, you know, a couple of months, like, and, you know, and quite a lot over a kind of 6 month period. So I did work quite closely with them to realize the work.
You mentioned fringing before. It seems to be in a lot of your work. That sort of tasseled finish.
Yeah, there has been a bit. You know, I mean, I certainly work with print a lot, and perhaps, you know, in some more recent collections, it has sort of been, I guess, in terms of working with print and geometric patterns and shapes and silhouettes, fringing sort of, whether it's fringing or, you know, another type of detail that comes off the body, it's sort of just a nice way to extend a movement. So yeah, whether it's for dance or just for a garment that you wear to the shops or, you know, to a party, it's just a nice way to sort of accentuate one's movement, I think.
Now, let's talk about some of your collections. They are pretty glamorous.
I hope so.
Yeah. They're, would you say, mostly towards the evening wear side of things?
I wouldn't.
No?
I mean, I don't do kind of evening wear.
Not in the
such.
Ball gown sense.
Yeah, with
but,
bunny ears.
But cocktail, perhaps, sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, it's really, you know, I really want the work to be relevant.
Right.
So, you know, there's a range of pieces within each collection that, you know, that you can wear to work or, you know, or out or, you know, pieces that you can dress up and down. Like, I think in today's world, you know, a lot of women that, you know, that buy my work or that could buy it, you know, they are busy. They are juggling, you know, work and or kids and or whatever it is that, you know, like, and they're not necessarily going home in between and sort of going, well, I've got my work wardrobe and I've got my going out. Like, it is sort of wearing something to work and then just like, you know, putting your flats in your handbag, chucking on some heels and, you know, flicking your collar up and you're kind of ready to
go to the cocktail party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I do try and work in some of those kind of details into the collection so they can be sort of mixed and matched and, you know, so it's not too sort of like work wear, evening wear, casual wear. Like, there is sort of a bit of each in all of them. So you could kind of virtually wear, you know, a casual dress to the beach and then sort of chuck on some heels and wear it out with some jewellery because there is enough going on. But at the same time, you're not going to walk down the beach feeling really overdressed. So, you know, and that's my challenge, to kind of get the right mix of things into each piece.
Silhouette seems to be very important to your design process. How do you work with that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to all fashion designers, but, you know, it's one of the things that we have on offer. You know, there's silhouette, there's embellishment, there's print, there's, you know, there's tailoring, there's drape, there's all these things that we can work with. So, you know, that's one of the things that we have, you know, to work with.
Is it, do you have a label or do you freelance for other brands or how do you create a business out of this?
It's an eponymous, it's Alexi Freeman, the brand.
Mm. Yep.
And I've just done, I think, 12 seasons over 6 years, sort of officially. Before that, I did do some fashion, which I did sell through boutiques. So, you know, but I guess it's kind of been a bit of a, like, apprenticeship at Alexi Freeman, in a sense, because, yeah, I did study fine art and I did work as a costume designer. And, it's really, you know, it has been working on the go and finding on the job and finding the right people to work with because, you know, I certainly didn't have the skills when I began, if I do now. But, you know, I guess what I do have is the intent and the dedication and the passion to bring my ideas into the world.
There are very few young designers that have lasted 6 seasons with their own label.
Well, 12 seasons.
Well, 12 seasons, 6 years.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know the stats, but I mean...
I can tell you there are very few that have managed that.
Yeah,
Is it getting anywhere for you? Do you feel that it's...
Oh, well, I don't know, Australian Ballet 50th anniversary.
Yeah, I know, like that's pretty good. But I mean in the sense of your own... a comfort within the label and the brand. Do you feel that it is sustainable for you?
I mean, it is sustainable in the sense that, you know, I have just done 6 years, you know, as, you know...
a success.
In the business.
Yeah.
I mean, without going on too much about, like, you know, it's not like I'm in debt to the bank or I don't know, like, I'm not, you know, like, it is kind of, I am in the black in that sense, like, it is kind of like a, you know, like, it's not like I'm not going on, like, holidays to Vanuatu every however often, but, you know, like, I work and it pays the bills
and how do you
it's rewarding.
Sure. How do you get a team together to make that happen, because you don't do it all?
Well, I mean, primarily I work with freelancers.
Right.
So, you know, whether they're printers or dyers or manufacturers or cutters or pressers or fabric wholesalers or knitters or, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people, as opposed to, again, working as an artist where I could literally have a concept, do it, maybe I might send it to the framers. But this is really, you know, and then once you've got the work done, it's working with photographers and makeup
Absolutely.
Artists and art directors and,
PR companies and magazines and
sales agents. And it is a, you know, I've got, I think, 4,000 contacts in my address book, most of which I use, you know, each year. Like, it's sort of, you do have to be in contact with a lot of people to kind of, so in that sense,
and that's called running a business.
Yeah, it does get easier because once you've got those contacts and you've started to sort of make those relationships, you know, people know you and they know that you deliver on time and that your quality is at a certain level, you know, obviously reflective of the price point. But yeah, I guess you do start to build trust, you know, with clients and, you know, boutiques and agents and press and all those things.
Alexi Freeman is our guest on Word for Word, fashion designer and costume designer for the latest production of the Australian Ballet titled Infinity. Dean Beck with you across Australia on the Community Radio Network. We'll be back with a little more right after this.
On the Community Radio Network, from Melbourne's Joy 94.9, this is Word for Word.
Dean Beck with you across Australia on the Community Radio Network. My guest, Alexi Freeman, is a fashion designer and costume designer. He's been working with the Australian Ballet. He's also been putting together a special exhibition. Alexi, tell us about what is going on down at Pieces of Eight Gallery in Russell Street, Melbourne.
Well, it's actually, I think we could almost see it out the window here, but I've been working in collaboration with jeweller Tessa Blasey. And we've created some new work in relation to our Autumn Winter 12 Rockstar collection. And it's installed at Pieces of Eight until the 7th of April. And it's open, well, it's viewable 24/7 until that time because it's in the window. So you can sort of head down there at any time of the day or night.
I'm presuming the Winter 2012 Rockstar collection is inspired by just that, rockstars?
Well, yes, but we did separate the word into two. So it is rock and star because there is this sort of, the piece that's installed down there is called Interstellar Gown. So sort of, you know, between stars. So there is this kind of intergalactic sort of sci-fi goddess kind of galaxy kind of feel that runs throughout. So yeah, we're sort of, you know, it's not just as direct as Rockstar, but there definitely is a bit of rock and roll kind of hotness in there.
A slash of Barbarella thrown in for good measure.
Yeah, a bit of, you know, a bit of a nod to Paco Rabanne for sure.
Fashion festivals seem to be ever-present in our modern-day culture, particularly here in Melbourne.
There's one a week, isn't there?
Pretty much, somewhere? Yeah. What's that process like? Have you been a part of festival culture, festival culture?
I have been in a few. I mean, indeed, our work downstairs there at Pieces of Eight is part of the LMFF cultural program.
What's it like to be in a fashion festival? I mean, I presume it's good PR, but is it a tedious process?
No, I wouldn't call it tedious. I mean, I guess the beauty of being in a festival rather than trying to stage your own, you know, completely solo event is that, you know, that it is quite, you know, it's like once the wheels start turning, maybe it takes a bit to get the wheels turning, but once they're turning, you know, it is sort of like a snowball effect. Like, you know, you get involved with a show or a group show that, you know, has a bunch of interesting designers in it, and the bloggers start tweeting it and blogging it and talking about it, and it can get quite, you know, talked about.
That's a really new, maybe 10 years, but that evolution of individual commentary on fashion has really been brought to the light in the last 12 months or so, particularly in the last couple of festivals. They've made strong mention of bloggers and tweeters. What is it like sort of seeing this third-person commentary on your designs? Because previously it was only editors of magazines.
I think it's really healthy, you know. I think it's like, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's diversity in a way, isn't it? Like, you know, as opposed to sort of just having, you know, the Anna Winters of this world, bless her silk socks. You know, it does give a lot of people a chance to voice their opinion. And, you know, it isn't just like all to do with who pays for the most advertising, who gets the best reviews.
And, or the
you
most
know,
smooching.
It's quite, yeah, democratic in a way. You know, you could almost say communistic. Like, it's just, it gives a lot of people who previously didn't really have a voice a chance to express their opinion and their feeling. And, you know, I think it sort of keeps the designers honest in a lot of respects. I mean, of course, now it's sort of gone, you know, full circle, and it's like designers gift things to bloggers, and it's, you know, they're just as kind of paid up, if you like, as the magazines
were. Equally in the loop.
You know, but that's life. Like, that, you know, that's just the way things go. But, you know, I think just anyone can get a blog for free and they can start talking about it. And if they have an interesting take on it for whatever reason, people will start reading it and reblogging it. And yeah, I think it's really, you know, it's really good.
Some of them are quite powerful. I mean, they've got a lot of followers.
Yeah.
That hang on every word, pretty much.
Yeah, we have. Next, we'll see, like, you know, bloggers turning into politicians or something, like the sort of actor politicians of the 2000s.
For you as a designer and a retailer, do you have to, or do you tap into that as part of your marketing tools?
Sure. Like, it's, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, in terms of the decline of the retail strip, you know, on there is a battle going on online throughout, you know, throughout the world in terms of retail. People are, you know, the days of just, you know, a store having a monopoly, you know, a physical monopoly, I think are pretty much gone. You know, people will go into stores, check things out, see if they can find it cheaper online, you know, throw their sort of caution to the wind and buy something from some, no offense to anyone in China, but, you know, Chinese kind of distributor on eBay where you don't know if it's real or not, but you just sort of go, well, I can't afford this $5,000 whatever Givenchy clutch, so I'll get this one from, you know. And I'm not judging that, I'm just saying that it's very real, and we have to contend with that as designers. And, you know, whether it's Zara or Topshop or, you know, the list goes on, they are here in Australia now, and, you know, we do need to sort of probably just, yeah, get that little bit smarter to sort of stay ahead of, yeah, I guess keeping our products relevant and different, because these big brands, they can, you know, knock it off in a week.
Indeed, you know, and when they can turn it around and ship it around the world in 10 days, that's got to be... that's got to present its own difficulties for you as a designer.
I mean, it's, you know, it's Darwinian, perhaps. It's survival of the fittest, you know, like it keeps you on your toes. You can't just sit there and keep...
It's a very diplomatic answer from someone who's become self-sufficient.
Well, look, it all, you know, it all goes around and comes around, and, you know, fashion is, in many respects, a cat chasing its tail. Like, you know, you could argue that, you know, anyone that's considered to be the most relevant or forward-thinking designer, you could follow, you could trace their influences back, whether it's, you know, Margiela or McQueen or, you know, whoever you want to look at. You could go, well, you know, look at this artist in the 1930s, look at the things they were doing in Dada, or, you know, there's always a justification for, you can see where, it's not like ideas come from nowhere. You know, everything has a history, and fashion, you know, goes round and round, and we're all trying to add out, you know, contribute to that. But yeah, I think it's all fair game. You know, everything's been done, everything's postmodern, everything's, you know, it's just, it's all open slather now, I think, which is fine.
What's the biggest time for you? Is it sort of spring carnival time, or is it Melbourne Fashion Week, or what do you aim for as your sort of... Is there a period, or is it just constant?
It's pretty constant. In a way, for me, it kind of winds down a little bit in December, just because, like, my birthday is Christmas Eve, and I tend to sort of start focusing on my party kind of around, you know, a week before that. But also around that time, in my experience, people stop buying fashion. You know, it's, they buy books and CDs and jewellery and small things that are under $100, or, you know, they start, whereas, you know, they stop buying kind of expensive.
And then come Boxing Day, it's on white goods and electricals.
Yeah, and we don't do, you know, many of those really affordable pieces, just, you know, not that we wouldn't like to, but just because we produce in Australia and it's ethically made and those types of things. So our price point tends to be a bit out of the gift buying.
Sure.
And then we don't make enough volume to warrant us doing huge sales either. So, yeah, that sort of gets a little bit quieter. But
you have a studio in Collingwood.
Yes.
Do you take commissions, one-offs, if, or is it about the range?
Primarily, it's about the range, just in terms of, you know, like, as I was saying, the seasons, they are relentless. They do come around, you know, twice a year, whether we like it or not. So, you know, we do have to very much focus on that. That said, if someone wants something, you know, from the range, slightly tweaked, we certainly are open to that. It's just, yeah, obviously the focus is on the collection itself.
And I presume if they pop into the studio, you can have it fitted.
They can, and we do a lot of that. You know, it is by appointment, but yes, people can come to the studio and view our samples and our stock. And
Alexi Freeman, you have something on display at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney.
We do, yes. It's another collaboration with jeweller Tessa Blasey, and it's part of the Powerhouse Museum International Lace Award. And they did have, I believe, over 700 entries. And, yeah, ours was shortlisted for the, for the Lovelace Prize. And it's been there, I think, for 9 months already. And now they've extended the show by popularity for another year until April 2013.
That's fantastic.
Got plenty of time to go and see that.
Check it out. If you're in Sydney, pop into the Powerhouse Museum. Alexi Freeman, thank you so much for joining us on Word for Word today and for giving us a few insights, not only into costume with the Australian Ballet, but into the fashion industry as a whole. It's been great to spend some time with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Dean.
You will find a podcast of this interview available for download from Joy's website, joy.org.au. If you would like to correspond with the program, please do so. Send an email to wordforword@joy.org.au. I'm Dean Beck. You can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck on Air. Till next time, you keep well, take care, and bye for now.
Word for Word is produced by Robert Briley and presented by Dean Beck from Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Melbourne's Joy 94.9. Word for Word is made possible thanks to funding provided by the Community Broadcasting Foundation and is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations in the Community Radio Network.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.